Any attorneys here? You know, I'm talking about a subject that's really their business. And I like to know when there's an attorney present so we can use him and you can get some free legal advice. Are there any attorneys here? Since there aren't any attorneys here, I can also tell you... are there? I can tell you my attorney joke. See, if there had been an attorney here, I'd tell you my doctor joke. It's the same one, really. You just switch it around. This attorney came home one day, and he came to the front door, and he was met by the plumber. And the plumber was just going out the front door, and he handed the attorney a bill for $50. And the attorney said, "Well, good grief, how long were you here?" And he said, "Oh, about 15 minutes. And he said, "Well, that's more than I make as an attorney." And he said, "What?" The plumber said, "Well, that's more than I made when I was an attorney, too." Well, let's get down to business. Maybe you wonder, what are we doing having a session like this? And we've discovered that many people, and I'm going to wander over here and get this blackboard while I'm at it, that many people manage their possessions well from a day-to-day basis, while many people don't really plan ahead and think ahead. And this is one of the things that we want to talk about tonight, is thinking ahead a little bit. Sometimes we think, well, having possessions is a sin. But as one of our men said, it isn't really a sin to possess a lot of material goods or to be rich, but the sin comes in the mismanagement of those possessions. And the Bible talks a lot, of course, about rich people. And today I think you and I know some people who've been blessed of God materially. Maybe they've inherited, maybe they've made it on their own, whatever it may be. And God has used them. And Laterna would be a good example of this. When I went recently to the conference area there in Toccoa, Georgia, the conference ground is there. The Southern Baptists of Georgia have that beautiful area and that beautiful conference ground because of a man like Laterna. And so God has used some of these men. And what we're going to talk about tonight regarding you and your possessions, I think, will be of vital importance to you. And I want to, first of all, share some passages of the Scripture. First of all, 1 Timothy 5:8. Now, we probably know that passage in the King James, or at least familiar with it. Let me read it to you from the Living Bible. It says, "But anyone who won't care for his own relatives when they need help, especially those living in his own family, has no right to say he is a Christian. Such a person is worse than the heathen." There is a responsibility to think through in terms of our care for our loved ones. And this is, I think, the essence of this passage. Sometimes we think, you know, as husbands and fathers, we think in terms of our family, our wife and our children and so on, and this is a responsibility. Let me give you another area here to think about and cite a passage of Scripture to go along with it. And I particularly run into this with single people, but it's true of us couples too. And this is our responsibility to our parents. And the passage is Matthew 15, 5 and 6. And again, I read it from the Living Bible. It says, "Even if your parents are in need, you may give their support money to the church instead. And so by your man-made rule, you nullify the direct command of God to honor and care for your parents." And once in a while, a serviceman or a collegian will come up to me and he said, "I've taken out a $10,000 life insurance policy and I've named the Navigators as the beneficiary." And I'm happy to hear it, but I ask him a few questions. I say, "Well, let me ask you a couple of questions. What about your mother? What's her situation? Is it possible that 5 or 10 years from now, your mother will need your help or your father will need your help?" And just want them to examine that part of the responsibility. Another passage that I think is good here is Genesis 41. And this passage talks about Joseph when he gathered during the 7 good years for the 7 lean years to come. Let me trace this thought with you. This isn't original with me. It comes from a friend of mine, but I think it's sort of an eye-opener. Part of the planning ahead, really, it may involve a number of things that we want to think about as Christians. We want to consider the possibility of death, of retirement, of disability, and this kind of thing, and planning ahead. Now, what in Joseph's situation, what he saw was the fact that he knew there were going to be some lean years, and he planned during the 7 good years. God has laid on your heart something with regard to some standard of living. Whether you live in a $75,000 home or a $7,500 mobile home or whatever you live on, you've got some standard of living. Something there that you know, you believe before the Lord, well, this is the money it's going to take to eat and so on and carry out 1 Timothy 5:8. And let's divide our lifetime into three areas. Let down here, it will say, is our earning. And let's use the first word as learn. During the learning years, the service years, college years and so on, where the income, the actual income, is usually below the desired standard of living. Most of us experienced that or are experiencing it. And then you get into what we call the earning phase. And that usually rises above the standard of living, but we are very resourceful individuals, and therefore we let the standard of living rise to meet the income. And then all of a sudden, you get to a certain stage where you realize, you know what? We're retired. And that's called the yearning phase. Well, planning, all I'm trying to bring out here is that planning means transferring some of this into a situation that plans for this. And the question is, you know, there is a Christian responsibility of planning ahead. How much, what you do, what your retirement plan is, how much you do for retirement, and so on, that's a very subjective thing. But there is a degree of planning. Proverbs 21:20 says, "The wise man saves for the future, but the foolish man spends whatever he gets." Proverbs 21:20 in the Living Bible. A couple of other verses that I won't give you the quotations on, but you can look at them later if you're curious, particularly about planning ahead. 2 Kings 20 in verse 1. 2 Kings 20 in verse 1. And 2 Samuel 17:23. 2 Samuel 17:23. And Proverbs 13:7. Proverbs 13:7. Did I need to repeat any of those? 4 words might describe what happens with respect to us and material possessions. 1 word is creation. Another word is accumulation. Another word is conservation. And another word is distribution. Now, you may think that the hard part is here, creation and accumulation. The businessman, the experienced businessman, will tell you that conserving what you have and distributing in a wise way to best benefit your loved ones is the harder part. And for the most part, what we want to talk about tonight is distribution. And let me again refer you to 3 words that I think will tell us everything we want to know about distributing property. In other words, what I'm talking about is, what happens in terms of your loved ones if you should die, husband, or in the case of a single person, with respect to a mother and father, or somebody that might be dependent on you? And again, 3 words would describe this. First of all, the law takes over. And we'll see in a minute, by a 10-minute film strip with a cassette, what happens when you die without a will, or you've made no plan whatsoever. In other words, Patty and I, if something happens to me on an airplane tomorrow, then if I don't have a will, I say, State of Colorado, you figure it out. And so they have laws of intestate succession, and the state of Colorado comes along and says, okay, this is the way John Watts' estate will be distributed, what there is of it, and it'll go to his family this way and that way and so on. And so this is what happens. The law. Every one of those states' laws are a little bit different. Secondly, we could distribute property by contract. That is, that I tell the Prudential Life Insurance Company, well, look, Prudential, I'll give you $10 a month if you will give my wife $10,000 when I die. That's a contract. I made a contract with them.
And as long as I carry out the conditions of my end, pay the premium on time, and then I die, they pay my wife. And the will doesn't have anything to do with it. The state of Colorado can't do anything about it, and so on. Another form of this would be joint ownership with rights of survivor. And so you and your wife, you own a house, husbands, and or wives, you own a house with your husband. And it's joint ownership with the rights of survivor. And so one dies and the other just takes over. You do have to be careful the way the title is written in order that that takes place. And sometimes you can be in sort of a joint relationship but not with rights of survivor. So that's sort of something you would want to watch. And then another thing is a trust agreement. We call it a living trust. I wish we had time to talk about it. It's an extremely valuable tool in this matter of planning distribution. There's a testamentary trust that's created in a will. We might touch on that later. But the living trust is another instrument that's extremely valuable, very, very good, and coming more into use as days go on. So the law and a contract, you can distribute property, and then finally by a will. One attorney defines a will as your direction in writing, which most economically controls the disposition of your property at death. Your direction in writing, which most economically controls the disposition of your property at death. In other words, it comes down to, well, if God, you sort of look at it this way, really, because this is the right way to look at it. Everything we have, we belong to the Lord. We've been bought with a price. The things we wear, the cars we drive, the homes we have, all the possessions, they all belong to the Lord. This afternoon we prayed, of all days, to pour cement. I poured cement in the patio this afternoon. Had one of our ex-NAV fellows over there to help me, and it rained. Well, when it rains and you're pouring cement, it's not the best combination. And I just prayed at dinner. I now look, Lord, you know, the patio belongs to you. I don't know what you have in mind with the rain, but it's yours. And you know, praise the Lord for whatever rain was there. Everything we have belongs to the Lord. This is essential, I think, to our thinking here. And so we may think, well, why do I need a will? And I'll come to that in a minute and name some areas that really make it sensitive to us. Because if what we have is important, if we feel that what we're managing today is important from the standpoint of good stewardship or good management before the Lord, then the way we distribute it for our family's benefit is also important. The first thing I want to do, or the next thing I want to do then, is to show you what happens when you die without a will. And we'll do it through these slides. I'll turn this pulpit around and turn this cassette on so we can pick up the... as we continue and we talk about what ought to be involved in a will and so on, I want you to feel the freedom to ask any questions or make any comments that you want to about anything you've seen or heard. First of all, one of the reasons that people don't make wills is a reluctance to face death. In fact, a lot of people feel that as soon as I sign my will, the chances are I'll be going any minute. And it isn't so. Secondly is procrastination. What's the hurry? My health is, I'm in good health, good situation, no problems. And I don't see any reason to hurry up with this thing. And of course, most of us know somebody who had an untimely, or maybe we should say timely according to Lord's timetable, of being called home or having an accident of some sort. Untimely to our thinking, our way of thinking. And then thirdly, we don't make a will because we have too little property. And I touched on this a little while ago, that if what we do have is important to us and we believe it's important to our family, then disposing of it is also important in the right way and in the most economical way. In fact, I'm sure that most of us here can't afford to blow too much. You know, in the sense of maybe a millionaire, or a person worth $10 million could afford to drop $1 million in the process of not making out a will properly or so on. But most of us, I don't think, are in that boat. One of our staff made the comment one day, John Crawford said, I think a lot of us are worth more dead than alive. So you may not think you're worth so much now, but there could be a lawsuit or something of this sort, and therefore a will would be important. A fourth reason people don't make a will is that it's too expensive, and therefore they'll write their own will. And this is a very dangerous practice. I highly recommend against it. In 20 of our 50 states, a holographic or handwritten will is legal. in 30 of the 50 states, it's not legal to write your own will. Now, an attested will is a will that's written up, usually typed, and attested means that it's witnessed. And if it's written properly and witnessed properly, why then it's a perfectly legal instrument. But it's a very dangerous thing for you to try to do that yourself. And therefore, the investment of whatever the attorney charges is well worth it. And most attorneys will charge from $15 to $50 for an individual will. You may call an office of an attorney or the attorney you're interested in, the attorney you're referred to, and they will be happy to tell you what the cost of a simple will is. And that's a simple will. If you get involved in this testamentary trust business, of course, it'll increase his time, and therefore the cost will increase. A fifth reason people don't make wills is they dislike legal documents. And this is true. I think all of us do. We sort of dislike contracts and things of this nature, and therefore we hesitate to do it. But it's probably the most important legal document we can enter into. A sixth reason that we don't make a will is the lack of ability to plan for the future. And this is a very real reason. It's difficult for us to sit down. I think one of the most difficult things is to decide, well, now, who would I like to ask to be the guardian of my 17 children? I only have three. But you know what I mean. It's not easy. And I did have a man, as a matter of fact, in Albuquerque about a year ago in a workshop we were having on wills who came up to me and said, I have 11, I've forgotten, or 12 children, he said. Now, you know, what do you suggest? I was really lost to say, you know, who is he going to name for a guardian? But the fact that we feel an inability to plan for the future is, you know, it doesn't remove the necessity to do so and think through it to the best of our ability. And one of the things about wills is they constantly need revision. It's sort of an as-needed situation. I can't say that they need it every 5 years, every 3 years. Your will might not need revision in 10 years. But then again, some of you who may be here and you're over 45 or 50, you look that will, get it out and look at it, and you'll be so surprised to realize that you named John Smith as the executor and he died 14 years ago. You know, some of the things, it's really surprising to see how much a will needs a revision. Another reason, a final reason, the seventh reason, is a reluctance to place confidence in others. Who can I trust? What attorney should I call? I've never gone to an attorney before. I was in an attorney's office today, and a man walked in and he said, I want to talk to an attorney about, well, I've forgotten what the subject was, but he says, I've never been, and she said, which one would you like to see? And he said, I don't know anyone. I've never been in an attorney's office before. And this is true of a lot of us. My recommendation is that you check around your local church or with some trusted Christian businessman and ask them, who is their attorney? Has he written their will? Are they satisfied? And pretty soon you'll see the light flash over one name a repeated number of times and settle down on that is the person as you pray about it and so on. And it's important who writes your will. Because some attorneys, for instance, don't really make it a... You know, wills aren't a specialty with them. It's a sideline. And that isn't the kind of an attorney you want to have write your will. From this point on, I'd like to have you feel free to ask questions. And I'd like to attack the subject of what we've seen, what happens when you die without a will. Now I'd like to talk about the will and what should be involved in it and what you might think about ahead of time. First of all, you'll want to think about an executor. Most wills are written so the wife is the executrix and the death of the husband, and the husband is the executor of the wife's will, and then there should be an alternate. And the alternate should be a person who, of course, could handle the affairs and distribution of the property in the case of a simultaneous death. And so you may ask, well, what kind of a person? Well, attorneys are frequently named as an executor. The banks are frequently named as an executor, usually in more complicated situations. My own personal choice is a loved one who has sound judgment, who knows enough to go and get the proper legal advice, and who loves your family and would look out after the best interests of your family. And I say that from experience. If there's a family problem, or there may be problem that would exist after you die, then that wouldn't be wise. If there's an outstanding attorney who knows and loves your family, he would be, of course, best qualified to do it.
Question.
Yes.
Should the executor be a resident of the state in which you reside?
Yeah, that's an important question, and I usually get to that point. It is usually the law. Well, I shouldn't say usually. And by the way, I am not a lawyer, and I'm not trying to practice law, and you will want to check me out, but I study the law pretty carefully and study this wills business pretty carefully. And I've worked with a lot of attorneys who haven't studied it as carefully. But I think you'll find that most of the things I'll say are true, except where I qualify the statement. I shouldn't say usually, but in many situations, the executor does have to be a resident of the state. Now,
a resident of the state where the will is filed.
Where the will is probated, admitted to a probate court. A probate court is a court that proves the will, proves that it was your will and your intentions, your signature, and the witnesses saw you sign, and that sort of thing, you see.
Does it make any difference if he was a relative?
Yes, it does. It does make a difference if he's a relative. If he's a relative, he can almost always serve in any state. But anytime you move or the executor moves, call your attorney and check it out. If you move, find another attorney and take your will down there when you change residences. For instance, here's a common thing. Well, let me stick with that point a minute. We have a staff member who resides in Florida, and a relative has terminal cancer, and she's named as the executrix in the will, and she said she's going to die any time. Can I act as the executrix while I reside in Florida, and the person's going to die, and the will's going to be probated in Oklahoma? And I said, write to your attorney or an attorney you know and find out. I don't know the answer to the question. The answer to the question was yes. She could serve. But in this case, it is really quite difficult because you're going to have to get a lawyer to do a lot of the work right there in Oklahoma City in this instance. Drawing up a will, for instance, in one state and moving to another, just to show you some complications that might come up. Now, lots of times the will will be good. You can make five moves and no problem, the will is fine. But, for instance, you might draw up your will in, say, Colorado a few years ago, and you had only two witnesses sign it, and you moved to Connecticut, and three witnesses are necessary. And so the will is invalid. And some other states are much more stringent about this point. Now, let me come back to this point, too, about the executor. Just come in anytime you want to. But on the executor, I feel, and from personal experience, I can cite quite a few instances where it would be so much better to somebody who has the empathy, the feel for the family, to be the executor. That's my point. A third party, a disinterested third party, is a difficult person to handle in the state, doesn't have the feel, couldn't care less. And I could cite you some instances, but I won't take your time to do so. I could give you some stories about it that have happened in people I talk to. Yes.
Say it is a loved one, the sound judgment, but of course we'll have to engage an attorney, even in disposition of the will. Does the charge, an executor and executrix, I believe, can't be allowed or paid so much?
Usually, of course, you name one thing you do, of course, if you have a will, is you name a person to serve without bond, and that eliminates the charge we saw in here where the bond is an insurance policy, and you don't have to take that out. There is, in every state, an executor's fee, and usually the executor's fee is so many percentage of the first value of the state and so much percentage of the next value and so much percentage of the next, and in some states it says reasonable and proper, which scares me to death because you never know what they're going to do, and I could cite some more horrible situations there which resulted. If I am serving as the executor of my mother's estate, I will not charge a fee, and I will sign a waiver saying I do not want to accept the fee. And that's what you can do if you're named, for instance. I'm named for a number of missionaries overseas, our staff, and people that aren't necessarily on the NAV staff but are overseas as missionaries, and they've named me. Well, the first thing I'll do is sign a waiver saying I don't want a fee for it. Now, the expenses will still come out. If I have to engage the services of an accountant to do a tax return or a lawyer, I'll pay that out of their estate. Okay, let's see. Any other questions on executor? Let's move on to guardian. Yes?
This came up just the day before we left. I don't even know because my sister-in-law called. And she's, of course, they both made our wills about the time just right after his parents both died. And she was all excited to be in the bank as an executor. And she was just heard of an incident out of the state where an aunt had left four nieces. Out of this estate, so far, she was quoting that each got $1,000, but the bank had taken 60 to
to run this estate, and to, is that, could that be true?
Well, it's a percentage. See, it's a percentage of the assets of the estate. Like in most states, it's about 7% of the first $10,000. So it costs $700 to have an executor handle it. In some instances, I can cite an example. For instance, it cost $11,000 in a recent will in Virginia I know about that's in our family. It was $125,000 to $150,000 estate. It cost $11,000, and the lawyer had virtually nothing to do. It was all real estate. It's just a matter of transferring the title to the deed. It really depends on the nature of the estate, whether you name somebody like that as an executor. You see, if it's a simple matter, you don't really have to hand it over to a bank or an attorney. The attorney will do the best job, most of them. They know this is their business. They know it well. But I value the sound judgment of a loved one who will then seek out the services of an attorney and just simply use the attorney where needed. A guardian. In naming a guardian, you face the same thing that you talked about a moment ago about the residency situation, too. And I think I should take time to cite a couple of cases here on the guardian situation. Normally, the court looks for a relative to take the children. Some of you here may be grandparents. I'm very close myself to being a grandparent, not very many years away. And I can tell right away that I'm going to really love my grandchildren. And this is a very natural situation. And if something would happen to my son and my daughter-in-law, I'm going to fight tooth and nail. I want those. They're my blood. I want those children. I can tell you right now. Now, whether I'm well qualified to be their guardian or not is another question. This is the way the court looks at it, too, is the natural situation. A lot of us in the Christian community often look for the other younger couple about the same age, same thinking processes, same godly heritage, and maybe for one reason or another, we do not name either mother or father or any other relatives. And we had a case out in San Francisco, out in the Bay Area, out there, Bob, near where you folks come from, that George Hardesty, the attorney, handled and told me about, where they named, first of all, the guardian they named was another young couple, not related. Christians, fine home, and they died in an accident of some sort. The guardians didn't die, the testator and his wife died. The alternate guardian they named were some relatives. Mixed home situation, I mean, one was Protestant, one was Catholic, and wasn't really somebody they wanted to leave the children to. And the court looked at it and said, well, the relatives have a greater right to the children. Now, the point I want to drive home there is that if you don't name an alternate, that isn't a good choice. And you might want to think twice before naming a non-relative if you really have well-qualified relatives. If you don't have well-qualified relatives, you may wish to ask your attorney to qualify the reasons you're not leaving them to the relatives, or not necessarily the negative side of the picture, but the positive side of why you selected such and such a couple. We only named one couple. We named a NAV staff couple and not related. And this is good. There's another point here, too, by the way. Now, see, if Patty and I, this NAV staff couple, live in Colorado Springs, but if they move, then I have to examine the laws of the state of Colorado, because here again we come to this point that you brought up about executor, and that is that naming a guardian couple and they move to Virginia, then the state of Colorado may not allow a unrelated couple that they have to sort of, you know, watch over what they're doing, and they have to give a guardianship report. They may not permit it to happen outside the state unless they're related. This is true in Florida. In Florida, you can't name another couple, to be the guardian of your children unless they're related to you, if they live out of the state. Question?
The thought just came to my mind when you were talking about this children. And you, as a grandparent, like your grandchildren, that occurred to me too. What would happen, say the children didn't have a will, and there's two sets of grandparents and both sets want them, how would that be?
It's a big fight. I think the judge will just decide on the basis of who's best qualified. Let me cite one other war story on this point, and this, I think, is important. We had a couple that was in close touch with us in Texas who named another couple, neither grandparents on either side. They had an automobile accident. One was killed and one was critically injured. In race, one set of grandparents rushed for the will to find out who's responsible for the children. I've never discussed it with them. Only to discover the Joneses next door or up the street or someplace. And this just enraged them. For the same reason that you're sensitive and so am I about it. And some others. Because they're my grandchildren. And so they, you know, it was a very sensitive point. The point I want to make here is that if you do name somebody else, be sure to tell those loved ones that might rush in, tell them ahead of time. And they'll be well prepared for it, and when they won't have to search for the will in the first place, they'll know who those children are going to and what responsibility.
Can you make a testament?
Yes. Good case, too. If there's no solid reason the grandparents shouldn't have the children, the court may turn it around.
Why face up to them? They'll let the children face up.
I don't know if I'm... Oh. Now, a child, by the way, I visited a lady out in Portland the other night, and she has... Her youngest is 16, and the court will often call a 16-year-old forward and say, now, what's your wishes? This will was written 15 years ago, and you were 1 year old, and it's leaving you with Aunt Bessie, but what's your desire? And they will, at the age of 14, have a great say-so in where they go. Any other questions on guardian? Yes. That's my feeling. We're very wide open in our total communications with our children. And I don't have any hang up on that at all. I think it's good. It won't come as a shock. In fact, I'd want to know if the children had a hang up about those people. And you know, I might discover something. Well, we just written our will and signed it today and left it on file with the attorney, and the child says, well, what would happen to us if... And we've gone over this with all the children. In fact, they just curiously ask us, well, you're going to go to live with the Metzgers. And, oh, that's great, you know. Next thing they'll ask is, how much insurance are you leaving us? Then they'll begin to make plans. Okay, so two positive things in a will. You think about the executor, the alternate, apart from the wife. You notice they used in here the word administrator. When the court appoints somebody, they use the word administrator. The court appoints an administrator for a person who died without a will. And the executor is the word when you use it. Okay, property distribution. In a will, you distribute property in the best interest of your family. This is an advantage that you have in this. Economy. When you make out a will, you can do it in the most economical manner. If you want to ask a question about taxes, it's not part of the agenda, but I'll be glad to answer questions that I'm capable of answering along that line. Personal satisfaction, you'll have the peace of mind that it's taken care of. So many people come up to me. I was telling Bob before we started, I think in the last year and 2 or 3 months, I've had 34 or 5 of these kind of sessions. So people are always walking up to me and said, since we heard you talk on this, we've made up our will. And I can really sense that they have a peace of mind about the whole thing. Then another thing you can do is create a trust agreement in a will. Now, my estate's not going to be really very much, but I've created a trust agreement. The question will come into your minds, should I burden the same couple who take care of the children with the task of taking care of the funds that we leave? If Patty and I die in an automobile accident, then the money goes into a trust agreement that's administered by a businessman that's on our staff. He's the trustee. He dispenses the funds according to what Ken and Doris Metzger request along this line. And they work together. He's a business mind, and he knows how to do these kind of things and invest the money. The insurance proceeds are payable to the trustee as a secondary beneficiary. My primary beneficiary is my wife, and the secondary beneficiary will be when I change it. I mean, it's okay because it drops into the estate if my wife isn't living anyway. And then, therefore, it goes to the trust agreement. But I'll change it anyway. Then it goes to the trust agreement, and the trustee manages it, you see. Now, that's not it's not a complicated thing. Any kind of a trust agreement only has 5 ingredients. It has a person who designs a trust agreement. It has beneficiaries. It has certain terms. It's dispersed this way and that. It has some property in it, and it has some beneficiaries. And when it's through benefiting certain people, then it's the trust agreement is dissolved and so on. The word is usually an irrevocable trust. No, it is not very good for most of us. The only advantage in any kind of an irrevocable, and what he means by that is the fact that you can never change it. You sign an irrevocable trust agreement. Means it cannot be changed. And usually the only reason the person does that is for the tax advantage. There's great tax advantage in it. And therefore, when a person possesses unusual amount of property, it can bring real tax advantage. My hang-up on that is that sometimes it would be a dangerous thing to do, to tie up your money in an irreconcilable, irrevocable situation. Another thing you can do, of course, in a will, and let me take off on this point a little bit, is make a charitable disposition. Yes. Question, somebody? Yes, ma'am. Yes. We get to that point, which Bob has told me we'll quit at 8:30, and we'll quit at 8:30, and I'll have... Are you having something in the King James?
You can join.
I'll do that. Thank you. My wife won't know that, but I'll do it anyway. Yes, ma'am. The reason for that is, for instance, in the simultaneous death of the husband and wife, it would be important that the wife's comments about the guardianship of the children would also be in writing. Then in some states, of course, they will treat the estate of a wife as a separate part. And in some situations, we'll decide whether the husband's property is this amount, if it's not all in joint ownership, for instance. And here's some property that belongs to the wife, and it will be distributed according to intestate succession. Let me come back to a person dying without a will. When a person dies without a will and they have no children, in many states, let's picture this now. In many states, a husband dies without a will, he has no children. In many states, the wife will only receive from one-fifth to one-half. This is an alarming statistic, and the rest of it will go to his mother and father or his brothers and sisters and not to his wife where he would intend that it go. So those are a couple of reasons that a wife needs a will. Yes?
If the property is in joint ownership, then it would automatically...
Yes. If it's written correctly, if it's in joint ownership in the sense that with rights of survivor, yes.
Does every state or every state differ?
It might differ a little, and I'm not going to try to be an expert in these areas. Title ownership in different states is really complicated. Generally speaking, when you have joint ownership with rights of survivor, then you die, bang, it's hers. And there are three kinds of property, by the way, that bypass probate. And it's good to have, the estate planners say, as a rule of thumb, it's good to have your family home in joint ownership. Maybe the car and, you know, some other minor things. But if you begin to accumulate, some of these businessmen that may be here tonight, they've accumulated some real estate. And as you build this everything up, stocks, bonds, real estate, and so on, in joint ownership, you've got a tax problem. It'll all be taxed twice. And we could, if you want to pursue that downstairs, I'll pursue it with you. I don't want to bore the rest of you who may not be facing it, but I'm just saying that as a rule of thumb, it's not a good thing to have everything in joint ownership beyond the family home. Yes?
Well, a car is something that you always
yes.
buy.
Yes, no problem there. What happens is you buy some real estate, sit on it 14 or 15 years, it's greatly appreciated in value. I could go through it, but I know that to a lot of it isn't applicable. What was I going to do? Oh, I wanted to tell you that on charitable disposition, this is something you can do in a will and you can't do otherwise. And this is the way I look at a will situation. First of all, a person makes a will. Usually when they get married, they begin to think in terms of that. Then the next time is when they're married plus children. And they begin to think again about a will if they still haven't made one. There are some single people, of course, who need to think about a will where they have property they've inherited prior to marriage and so on, and what would happen to it if they died without a will. And in another situation where you think about maybe changing your will is where you're married, but you're minus the children because they've gone out of the nest and they're on their own. And I really feel that the major part where you can really begin to think in terms of the Lord's work is over here. In other words, what can I do to use some of these material possessions to give them you don't give the management over to somebody like the Navigators or Wycliffe or your church or what have you. Over here, I see only one area where you and I are going to, while we have children at home, going to think in terms of the Lord's work in our will. And that is as a contingent beneficiary. The way I have it written, the Navigators receive the whole thing if Patty and I and the three children die in a common accident. This is possible. Not too probable. We had it happen a couple years ago out in West Covina, California, where a family all died in a private plane crash, and you know, I wondered about their will in that situation. I have no idea what happened. So as a contingent beneficiary. Then there's one other thing, of course, before I would say that, I know I'd want to examine my mother's situation or my father's or Patty's mother's and so on, you see, because of Matthew 15 and 1 Timothy 5:8. I started to take off on another point, by the way, which I didn't complete, and I have a bad habit of doing that. And that is, what property bypasses the probate procedure? The life insurance bypasses probate. In other words, your will is written, and your will says this, and you have a life insurance policy, and it's made out to your wife, and the will doesn't have any control over that. Unless you name as the beneficiary of your life insurance policy your estate. Another type of property, of course, is a joint ownership, and another thing is living trust agreement that would bypass probate. By the way, I have a Reader's Digest article that describes the living trust that was printed about 2 years ago, and I didn't put it out there in the table. You notice I put some propaganda out there in the table about planned giving, and I didn't put it out there because I don't have many copies. But if you would like one, you could let me know or put your name on a piece of paper, and I'd be glad to send one to you. And another thing I want to mention before we close off here in 5 minutes, I put some yellow cards that look like this out there that request more information or an appointment. And I want you to know my job is to travel from coast to coast, which I spend 40% of my time doing, and just visiting with you folks, and I'm glad to do it, whether you're a donor, whether you're about to make a gift or not. I'm glad to go over any of these things with you or work with you on it. And if you want to fill out a card and request an appointment or more literature, something you don't see, I'd be glad to do it. Now, somebody had a question. Yeah.
You say, say you don't have any children, as a couple, your children in automobile accident, you have made no will at all.
You have no children.
Does the state get all that then?
No. No, the only time the state really gets it, this is kind of a misnomer. If people feel, well, you know, if I don't leave a will, the state of Colorado will get everything. And this isn't true. They'll make a diligent search to find relatives. But sometimes it's most difficult. And I could cite some examples there again, where the state spends a lot of your money looking for your relatives in order to distribute the property. Yes.
I have a question.
Just
quickly, it happened in our town where the wife and children, no will. The relatives argued for a year and a half who died first in the accident.
Right.
They had all kinds of people on the stand to find out if he or she were breathing when they loaded up in the ambulance, so that either family could get to the estate, which was sizable.
Yeah. Oh, you'd be surprised what happens when you die without a will. Now, yes. You know, this they get into fierce arguments.
One of the things I think that some people here should know, maybe you have information about it, is the special position that adopted children
take. No, I'm not too qualified to talk about that. Maybe you'd like to. Well, I'm just going to sort of conjecture. I kind of felt like there was something a point he wanted to make here that he knew about. I feel if the children are legally adopted, now usually the will read, you know, any more children born to this marriage later plus any legally adopted. And once they're legally adopted, then I think...
Suppose you don't have a will and you have these legally adopted children.
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
We were told in our two children that are adopted that unless we specifically name them, my mother, my wife's folks would come in before they would. Her brother.
That sounds very, very logical to me. Very possible. It depends on the laws of the state. Again, they're very peculiar. They change. They're so different from one state to another. You see, we have a whole string of community property states that have a peculiar law.
In other words, if you've got adopted kids, check it out.
That's right. Well, check out all the things. Well, one of my objectives tonight is just to stir up your pure minds. to see your attorney and get this taken care of because of my introductory comment that we, most of us, plan pretty well from day to day, but few of us plan ahead wisely, and I think it's a scriptural thing to do, to plan ahead and to think about some of these things. And that's what, this is what I want you to do, because I know it's going to benefit your family. And see, another thing that's not an ulterior motive, but this is true. I can cite examples of this situation. The work of the Navigators, the work of Wycliffe, the work of your church, the work of other mission organizations will benefit because you've conserved your property 30 years from now. So this is going to happen. I know it's going to happen. So your family will benefit, and so will the work of God. Yes?
Other than that, would it be better to put that in your wife's will, maybe, to give it to Wycliffe or something like that, since she would be there after you to take care of it?
That's something you never can figure on. You know, it's usually figured that way, though. You see, I have a fellow I'm working with on the West Coast who's very wealthy, and everything is configured on the fact that he's going to die first. And this is bad estate planning. The estate planners say, even everything up. Now, you know, if God has given you some material possessions, you've got to begin to think about this idea of evening. I mean, estate taxes become a very vital part. They're a huge tax. And there's a little committee, I don't want to get too political here, but there's a committee at work in Washington now on a tax reform act that'll raise what little hair some of us have left. I'm telling you, it's going to make our tax laws today look pretty liberal, pretty easy to stand by. But these taxes will really go up. Let me make one comment here. We are exactly at the time to end, and therefore we want to stop. I want to just say one more caution, that's all. And that is, on the signing of your will, a lot of wills have been invalidated by a poor signing technique. You know, the wrong thing with respect to witnesses. And I'll cite one example of this to show you how very strict the courts can be. It's important how you sign your will. And a lot of times attorneys, I wish they wouldn't do this, they'll mail the will out to you and say, here it is. And maybe even orally over the phone they said, now get a few of the neighbors together and have them in and be sure and have them see you do this and do that. And you forget what the attorney said and you bring the people in, they sign it, and you sign it, and that's all. And the court can be very strict. In last December in Kansas City, a businessman died, and the executor of the estate told me this story, and I could tell you some more beyond this one, but this is enough, I think, to prove the point. He said that when they went to the probate court with a will, that the morning before, they sat down with the three witnesses, the executor did, and said, now, this is what the court will do. This is what the judge will tell you. And he'll ask you, if you were there and you saw that the deceased signed the will and you saw the other person sign the will. And one of the ladies said, well, do I have to tell the truth? And the executor said, oh, yes, you should tell the truth. And she said, well, just as soon as I'd signed it, I ran across the street to get my cookie recipe for Mrs. Smith, who was going to sign. So I never saw the other people sign. I did see the testator, but I never saw the other witnesses. Kansas and Missouri are both two witness states. And I can't remember whether this was Kansas City, Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas, but the judge threw it out. There were three witnesses on the will. One witness was invalid. So there were still two witnesses. And he still threw it out. That I can't understand. But that's just to illustrate the fact that the signing and witnessing of a will can be a very important point. Now, I'll stick around and have something with you. You want to give any dismissing remarks or anything?